Legacy Women in Music podcast celebrates women of Canterbury whose vibrancy and passion for songwriting, performance, and various forms of musical advocacy have woven a tapestry of important contribution to our region and its communities. I'm your host, Lynette Diaz, and you're listening to the Legacy Women in Music podcast.
Dark is the evening, silent the hour. Oh, who is that minstrel by yonder lone tower, whose harp he is so tenderly touching with skill? Oh, who could it be but Ned O'Hill?
Denny Stanway kicks off the Legacy Women in Music series after 4 decades as a lead singer in genres as diverse as contemporary, acoustic, folk, and Celtic, including collaborations with Acoustic Confusion, Wayne Gillespie, Mahinaranga Thakur, Toru, and most iconically, Rua, which included her husband and musical partner of 30-plus years, Jimmy Young. It was difficult to track Denny down, as she's been in hibernation for a few years. In the end, she was gracious and gave of her time generously. We met at the Plains FM studio in January 2020, and, well, our conversation just took off. And here she is, Denny Stanway, in her own words, her legacy.
Look at all those CDs. That's the past staring right up at you.
It is. What do I feel?
Yeah.
Overwhelmed, because apart from the very early Auckland material, which was all around early acoustic scene, the rest of all of this is very much a partnership with my husband, who passed away.
Yeah. What year was that?
It was Christmas 2015. And I still struggle over that period of time now. You know, Christmas and New Year just, I've sort of eradicated slightly, because it was very meaningful time for us, both at the terms of that's when we met and, yeah, time that we gathered people together as well. It's heartfelt, that's what it is. And it's almost like I'm a different person looking through this, and it's looking at someone else's life, to be honest.
Did you two meet through music?
Yes, we did. We met through Acoustic Confusion, having an extraordinary invitation, because we were an Auckland group, and I don't know how it came about, but we got invited to be guests at the time, one of the biggest folk festivals in the country, Forre Flat, just outside of Dunedin, a New Year event. And they'd stretched out a bit beyond in their musical guest list, I suppose, so we didn't expect it, but we were invited. So anyway, we went down there, and it was a New Year's festival, like 5 days.
Yeah.
And little did I know that the band that they'd brought in that had, was also guesting that weekend, was the House Band, and they were the very first real Celtic. They were the real deal. They were from the UK. They were from Northumberland and Scotland. They had a massive background of absolute integrity and tradition. And I had no idea what they did or anything, you know. And it's a very big guest list back then. It was a really big festival. And you go and you build up yourselves. You work very hard, because you're representing not just yourselves, but you're sort of representing your scene.
Right.
And we were very much aware of that, that we were like the Aucklanders. And even back then, there was that whole dicky thing about the, you know, the Aucklanders, and here we were coming to the South Island.
Right.
For me, it was really wonderful and exciting, because, of course, that's where I was from. I was born and raised in Invercargill. So you might leave where you grew up, but you don't ever take some of that away from you. It's always part of you, isn't it, you know? Anyway, I went down there, beautiful place, just gobsmackingly amazing, the site, which they still operate from all these years later.
What year was
that? That was 1985. right in the middle of the 80s. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, then we got put up in cabins and... so you have your wee cabin that you sleep in and you gather in with its wee room in it, and lots of great sessions happen late at night with people coming in and gathering and playing music and having a good time. Drinking a lot, of course.
That's kind of part of the folk scene.
Back then.
Yeah.
We're all a bit too old for it now. But anyway, yeah, this band was there, and I didn't really take any notice of them, actually. It was funny. And how they operated it back then is that on the first night, there was sort of like a taster of a concert, and they had a huge marquee set up, like one of the big, like a circus marquee, massive, because there were several thousand people at that event.
Wow, actually quite huge.
Yeah, it was big. So it was quite something to be guests there, I felt at the time. And we were well rehearsed. We did a lot. We did our own material and a lot of harmony, and it was very much contemporary music. So we did a taster along with lots of other guests on the first night. Anyway, there was a lot to do there. You do workshops when you're guests. You have your daytime concert. You get a spot in the evening, the last night concert. But also in the very middle of it all is the New Year's Eve celebration. And I have to say, over all the years I've been at, I go to festivals. One of the best places you can go to in New Zealand to enjoy a new year completely and utterly is a folk festival, because you just there's a dance, there's which you can choose to dance in or not dance in, mm-hmm. but the gathering of like-minded people, I don't know, somehow it frees you up. You're away from home. By the time you get to New Year's Eve, you're sort of settled in. You know, there's nothing to do the next morning. You can do what you like. And right. It just builds and builds. And you just have a wonderful night.
Yeah, and it's equal for guests and performers.
Absolutely, because there's no by that time, I think that's about... In most festivals here that operate on a... There's only a couple now that operate on a New Year. It's like, it's about the third day. So you've done some work, you've done most of what you've been asked to do, you're in a more relaxed mode, you know, and they pull a band together and heaps of other people join in, and it's just a great deal of fun. And then, of course, your big countdown. In Dunedin particularly, it's generally done by Scotsmen, because there's quite a number of them down there. Sometimes there was a piper, you know, and you'd end up hearing these lonely pipes after the bells count down. So it was pretty emotive time as well, you know. But anyway, the next day, they were a pretty amazing group of people in Dunedin. They had a market. Remember, it's the 80s, which is just not far off the 70s. So there was a lot of craft and nice things. And what they did was they had this New Year's Day market in the marquee, you know. So I thought, oh, I'll go and have a wee look down there. And there was things, you know, and I bought a couple of lovely little pots so that they were my memory of the festival. But anyway, later in the afternoon, there was a scheduled concert, and it was the house band. So this was the four boys from the UK and Scotland. Mm-hmm. And I'd never heard anything. I hadn't travelled down that road of Celtic music or traditional music. I knew of traditional music mm-hmm. because I was involved in folk music in Auckland. But my love and passion was contemporary music and all the harmonic stuff. I was right into Crosby, Stills and Nash and all of that beautiful, warm, chordal, vocal stuff. Yeah. So it wasn't really, and I didn't know a lot of traditional music back then. But anyway, the whole market thing's winding down and things are happening on the stage for this international big act. And I wasn't even going to stay for it. You know, I thought, I've had a bit of a day, you know, I'm full after the new year and everything.
Found some destiny intervening.
Absolutely.
Here.
And the whole thing started to fill up because they brought in back in the chairs and everything. And, these four guys get on stage, and I'm sort of like chatting away to someone, and then they start their first number. Well, honestly, within like 16 bars of music, I had stopped, turned around at the stage. I was standing at the back because the marquee was full, and, you know, another 16 bars, and my packages were on the ground. I was transfixed by them, and their music was just direct to your heart. You know, it was just this powerful, it was very beautiful because they were very, very good. They were just amazing musicians. And then the concert developed, and then they were multi-skilled, so you know, there were strings, and it was Ian McLeod from Scotland, who was at the time and probably would still be one of the legendary mandolin players in the genre of Celtic music, which can be very fast. You know, it's like where a lot of where bluegrass came from was from the immigration of the Scots and Irish to America. You know, and those people, all that tradition was something that they all, that many of them grew up with, and it was passed down because that was the entertainment. Sure. It was your entertainment of an evening was the dancing and the music. So their skill in playing was just mind blowing, and the speed of which Ian played that mandolin, because of course you've only got such a little neck and close strings. It was just like, oh, and the other thing I didn't tell you was he'd had a really good night the night before as well. Had embraced New Zealand because they were on a huge tour, so playing at the Dunedin Folk Festival was coming towards the end, so they were very relaxed and having a good time. He was wearing the most inappropriate pair of shorts that you've ever seen in your life, and which quite blew my mind because, you know, we were very much into having a presentation. We were quite different in the folk scene then because a lot of people just didn't care. They'd just get up and whatever they were wearing. But we'd always thought, no, when you perform and you've put all those hours and time into presenting for your audience, then part of the presentation is also yourselves and how you present yourself. You know, I'm not saying that we didn't sort of dress up like the Beatles and have suits and things, but we always had our stage stuff. Yeah. And in a sense, I didn't quite know this back then, but I've certainly thought about it since, is that you're being paid to do a job, not very much back then and not very much still, apparently.
Right. Yeah,
it hasn't moved much. There's been no increase in the hourly rate. Okay. So very much it's music that you're moved by your passion for it. But I've always believed that when you're on stage, you owe it to your audience to present a unified, and especially in a group, you know, that you work through how your presentation, your hour or whatever you're playing flows in terms of speed, light and shade. And the fact there were four of us, there was, this is an acoustic confusion, we all sang, apart from Brendan Power, who was at the beginning of his incredible career as a world-leading harmonica player. And he was very shy, Brendan, so he would never say very much, but his harmonica spoke lots for him. But we all would take turns at doing introductions, and you had to learn that stagecraft. And, of course, the house band did the same thing. When you're working outdoors or in those sort of events and venues, your strings, guitars, mandolins, fiddles, everything, the tuning is a nightmare. Julian, who was the guitarist, and Chris Priestley, in Acoustic Confusion, brilliant ears, wonderful ears, a great pitch. It was a very constant thing about keeping those instruments in tune. So then you had to develop all that stagecraft and the stories and attempts at jokes, which I was always hopeless at, to sort of have a continuum throughout your performance. Well, I saw the masters of it at that New Year's Day concert. You know, they'd been playing music for a lot longer than we had. We're part of the very strong UK scene. Yeah,
so the short shorts didn't matter at that point.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, every woman in that entire festival fell for him. I think they fell for everybody in that, because they were unique, they were new, they were outstanding musicians. They were also very charming and very good at the patter and the stories and stuff, because their music wasn't strictly traditional. It wasn't just traditional jigs and reels and things. They were they'd contemporized the music as well, so they had their own take. And I mean, they did a version of, might not remember his name, but an amazing song called War Party, which was a big reggae song. Well, they Celticized that with all this incredible pipes and stuff in it. So going back to what happened when I'm standing in that tent, and they start and they go through, and of course they're doing different stuff, and there's this gorgeous man sitting in the middle. So we've got Ian on the far on one side in his dazzling, by the way, they were tartan shorts, very short, tartan shorts. And he had good legs.
I have this picture in my
head. Oh, there'll be pictures out there, believe me. I think, you know, but this was before cell phone cameras and stuff, you know, but there would have been a few photos taken. And it was very hot. It was a beautiful weekend weather-wise. So they were all very kind of cool and casual. Anyway, in the middle, so there was Ian McLeod, who then went on to be one of the founding members of Shugle Nifty, a huge band that gathered an international reputation. There was Jed Foley, who was one of the lead singers and beautiful guitar player. Chris Parkinson, who was Melodeon, which is that little smaller, quite unique sound that's not an accordion but played similarly, and keyboards. And then there was this very interesting, dark-looking man sitting in the middle with a cap on his head, bright red. I think he had a pink shirt on. So they'd all kind of, I don't know, somehow or other they'd embraced the New Zealand colours, you know, and just embraced being here and, yeah, and maybe too, because I didn't know it then, how hard a whole tour was, and they were coming to the end. It was one of their last big events, so there was a relaxedness about that particular concert. Anyway, going back to when I first met Jimmy, who was the fourth member of the band, he was this beautiful man, and he would stand up and play flute, which was the wooden flute, which were made of a hardwood that was played in Irish music, not the concert flute, the beautiful old instrument. And I learnt later that was very rare from the 19th century, when they first sort of embraced flute music into the Celtic music. Mm-hmm. And it sounds amazing. It's a lead instrument as well. But Jimmy's skill was such that he would play it in both a kind of an underway, you know, so it wasn't lead, but also lead along with the melodeon. So it took place of a fiddle, in a sense. Mm-hmm. His playing of that was breathtaking. And the sound of his instrument was beautiful. It was rich and soulful. So he would stand and play that, and when he stood and played it, it was like the instrument and him were just one. You know, there was just this incredible fluidity in how he played. He was also incredibly handsome. You know, he had that beautiful olive skin like you, Lynette, with this incredible moustache.
I always remember the moustache. I've only met him a few times.
Yeah, the moustache was one of his signatures, which, well, he didn't do it deliberately. It was just something that was him. And we're talking about a moustache. I mean, it's not just a little one. It was the fabulous, what would you call it, handlebar?
Yeah, where they kind of curl around.
Yeah. So, and it was very... not the word, I was thinking of plants when they're verdant.
Yeah.
Anyway, and he was very brown, and he was wearing this soft pink T-shirt, and see, I can tell you, I can remember all of this pretty well.
You've got details.
I've got details in this red cap. And then they did another piece where he sat, and there was this, and I'd never seen them before, was the Northumbrian pipes. And I didn't know what they were, but the sound that came out of that was utterly, like, I think when he first played that, the whole place just hushed. It was just amazing. Well, anyway, get to the end of it. So, of course, I'm standing there utterly spellbound. I don't know any of them. We haven't met formally or anything.
Yeah, so the whole 3 days,
because we hadn't engaged. We were all doing our thing. They're doing their thing. Quite a large festival, so there was a lot going on. And I'd never done this in my entire life, ever, 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 ever. Basically, it's often people think that if when you're a performer, and you may well relate to this, I'm sure a lot of performers can, you're often not what people think you are.
I completely relate to that.
Yeah. They think that you must be this amazing outgoing person and, you know, you never get nervous and la, 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 and which is the complete opposite for me. And you're nodding away, so I know that it's the same for you.
I think most people, we have that other side to us. You know, there's the what we present to the world, and then, you know, our internal world is, so different.
It is. Almost opposite, really.
Yeah.
So, and it takes a long time. I mean, I remember when I first started singing publicly, it was at a folk club in Auckland, and I was dragged up. Well, I couldn't open my eyes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was excruciating for me. You know, I did it because there was so much support, and the person who was playing with me had so wanted me to do it. So it was really like, feel the fear, but do it anyway. push yourself. But really, most of me wanted to run away and hide. I wasn't embracing it at the time. It was like, okay, and the nerves were just incredible. I just don't know how many times I went to the toilet before I first sang. And I remember having a long fringe, and I had the fringe right down, so it half covered my eyes, and my eyes were shut. And I don't know how I ever got through it, to be honest. That was the very first time I sang in front of people. And I always carried that. I always got very nervous before a performance, no matter how much work I did.
There's something humbling about that, though, that as a performer maybe keeps you in check and reminds you that things can come and go in an instant, and the focus, you know, if it's something that you truly love, will take you back there.
I think that's what makes you, that's what takes you over, you know, the other side of it, makes you walk onto that stage then, is that exactly.
Yeah.
It's like you move that you have to do it, and gradually you learn, which I did over many years. I used to try and figure out how I could get rid of them. You know, how could I get rid of this nervous, it was literally like my stomach would just turn inside out. And the other thing that used to be really funny, I'm sorry I'm going off,
Billy
Connolly, but I will get back, because it does relate to me doing what I did to meet Jimmy. Anyway, I used to just turn my bedroom inside out, like nothing worked, you know, and I'd eventually learned to have a little separate part in my wardrobe that was to do with stage and singing only.
That's great. It
all worked, and no matter which way I put it together, it was okay. It would do the job. But in those early years, I didn't know what I was doing. So I'd come home after a concert or a gig, and my room would just be a disaster.
The external showing what the internal was looking like at the time.
Yeah, and I think that might also be part of a personality type. I've never really shared that side of it with people, but I've always been open to when young ones have come up to me or new people have come up and said, Dean, you know, I'll always share my own experience because that's all I've got to go on.
Mm-hmm.
A, I had no training, so I can't tell anyone how to sing, but I can share what I did. So that goes around that whole stagecraft thing as well. I mean, honestly, it still drives me nuts when I used to go to something and I see someone get up and it looks like they've just got out of bed. And I'm sitting there in the audience giving them my time because I want to hear what they're going to do. And I think you could have, I don't know what it is, maybe I'm just old school, where I think you could have made a bit more of an effort. In concert, I'm not talking about busking, doing a floor spot at a folk club, but I'm saying when you are, it's a paid gig, then I think you owe that. But anyway, I'll go back to the whole nerve thing. So at the end of the concert, which was just, I don't know, I think they got three encores. I mean, blew everyone out of the, they blew the whole audience, right? I'm standing there thinking, I don't know what to do. This is just changed my life. I didn't know that at the time either, how true that was going to be. Normally I would just move away, you know, and you chat to people outside and go, God, wasn't that incredible?
That was amazing.
You know, and wow, and I loved that, and what did you, you know, you do that sort of thing. Well, I stood there and I watched what was going on. Of course, they got swamped. And because it's so festivals, folk festivals, and that, like, even maybe general music festivals when they're not like 10, 20, 30,000 people, you're more accessible as a performer.
Yeah.
You know, you're more accessible to everyone that's been to your concert. And they're also selling CDs. So, of course, the place just gets, the stage gets swamped. And they're there for quite a while. And I'm thinking to myself, I was watching, going, I need to make a connection. And there was only one person I felt like doing that with, and that was Jimmy. I had to wait around a while because there was a bit of a queue. It was really interesting because a lot of it was women. They really did make a considerable impact in every sort of way. Eventually, he was at the point of packing up his instruments, and I felt just so stupid, to be honest. But gradually I got up to him, and I just blurted out something like, you know, how wonderful they are, and oh, that music and all the rest of it, because I don't think they really truly realised, they maybe did after Fourie Flat Festival, that we hadn't been exposed to this.
Mm-hmm.
geographically, we were so far away from Europe and the UK to have a high-ranked up-there legends coming to this little backwater New Zealand at the time. That I don't think they got that till they probably bloody left. A lot of things, they actually precipitated quite a lot of change, them coming and playing throughout the country. A lot of music sort of developed more after that particular experience of the house being coming. So anyway, Jimmy and I just sort of blurted out some inane, you know, you're all so amazing and la la la. And he was, you know, was just very brief and polite. And away, and then I went, and then I kicked myself saying, why did I do that? I'd never sort of put myself in this position of like almost a groupie waiting for a wee pearl or a little something at the end of the gig. I just went away and went, oh, don't ever do that again, you know. But anyway, moving on through that, we had a concert the following day, Acoustic Confusion. It was an afternoon one. And it was lovely. And, you know, we got to play our full set of music. And that was our sort of big...
Yeah, and you're up there singing lead.
Yeah. Well, singing lead on quite a lot of stuff, but also harmony and a lot of other.
Yeah.
So, that was beautiful and it went really well. At one point towards the end, I just saw, because it was packed, which was very, you know, really nice... And I saw him at the back, and then I didn't see him because I was concentrating hard. But anyway, later on, it was really interesting because I was in our cabin, and Forey Flats set up. It's got hills and it's got a little river, and it's just amazingly gorgeous place. And I was standing in our wee lounge and looking out the window. I didn't realise that they had a cabin towards on the other side of us. And the weird thing was, he was standing in his cabin doing something and saw me.
I am enjoying where this story is going.
Well, this was the life-changing side part of us because our eyes locked and it was like, oh, my God. And neither of our eyes could pull away. So I had only said that blah, blah, blah thing after their concert, and I'm sure he didn't even connect that it was me. He'd been to our concert. So there was an acknowledgement then that, there was a putting together, you know. So I'm in this wee kitchen, and I'm all by myself. He's in the next cabin, and he's looking through the window, and I'm looking through the window. And there was just something occurred. I don't know what it was. It's one of those things that poets write about, but... you can't really say it yourself.
First time ever I saw your face, I felt the sun
were busy and we were involved and we were playing with other people because that's what happens at these things. People come up and say, oh, that would you come and do something on this song with me? And you end up getting really quite busy. And that's something else that makes those festivals really special because you make new connections, new musical collaborations happen.
There's a real community.
And it's very open. Like, no one is kind of, like, left out. If people want to come and sit around listening while you're practicing with someone, that's cool. I think it's a pretty unique environment, to be honest. So that's how we met. Out of that, we had some time just talking and... we didn't play together or anything, but what we did as a band, we found out that they were leaving Auckland in about a week's time. They had no concert in Auckland. Well, this is Acoustic Confusion, so this is the four of us, and we're going, what? This is ridiculous. You've just blown everything out of the water here.
Yeah.
So do you know what we did? I've still got the full-page newspaper, New Zealand Herald, blinking full front page, about what we did. We got, as soon as we got home, back to Auckland, we got on the phone. We booked the Glue Pot, which was the famous pub in Ponsonby at the time. The whole upstairs was a music venue, which could take a lot of people. We just got onto it. All of us worked like banshees for...
Sounds inspired is what it sounds like.
We were inspired to do this. So we did it. We pulled all the stops. Graham Reed, I think, was the big entertainment writer for the Herald at the time. We got him into it because we made sure we had some. We had an album. Mm-hmm. There were albums back then, Lynette.
Yeah.
Artists.
They're coming back.
I know, but artists, we had to travel. We did too, with LPs.
I love that.
I know, but can you imagine on aeroplanes and you're playing outdoors and you've got bloody LPs to sell?
You've got to watch for the sunshine.
Yes, So what we had back then was LPs and cassette tapes. This was pre-CDs even. Mm-hmm. Sounds like so long ago, doesn't it? I don't feel it's that long. But anyway...
But the 80s were cool.
Oh, they were. They were cooler than what I ever imagined they would be when I look back. But that's another story, isn't it?
Yeah.
But going back to the... We got them on. We got all the publicity that we could. And we went on as... Because we had a profile in Auckland. We were well known in our scene. So it was a double header. Acoustic Confusion with the house band. Now, no one up there had ever heard of them. When we set it all up, great sound, we got the sound people in, the whole thing. When we got there, seven, there was a queue. Because we had no idea, eh? We didn't know. We were getting to the point. We did all the work.
You were taking a total punt on this.
Yeah. We did all the work, but when we didn't know if we were going to manage to bloody pull it off, pay the sound people, the lighting, and we did a really good job. So we were prepared to take no money. I can't remember what we put on the door. It was affordable, but just that little bit more. And the story that Graham did on them with an amazing big full picture was incredible. I mean, we packed it. It was standing room only. This was about 2 days before they were due to fly back to Britain. And we put on, and we had an incredible gig. And we rehearsed together that day, and they came on board and played some stuff with us, particularly the fast stuff, you know, that they could just jump in, and because they were just such intuitive musicians, and they just took the house down. Really, it was amazing. And 2 days later, we all went out to the airport and farewelled them. And did stupid shit up in the up on the roof, because we could get on the roof of the Auckland airport then. We had Acoustic Confusion on the roof doing all sorts of silly things, like trying to say bye with our hands and arms and things, and we watched them as they taxied away. What happened the following year, without me really realising, Jimmy and I wrote a little bit, but our lives went back to... This is that weird thing that we were talking about earlier. You have a life at a festival that's completely of its own, you know, and then you go back to real life. That's just the same as when you're going off and you're doing
like
a concert.
It's almost like summer camp or something, you know?
Yeah.
It's
like, then you go back to reality, work and whatever else you've got to do. And those boys were professionals. That was the difference too.
So what were you doing those days when you weren't doing music?
Well, as a mum, my little boy Josh, luckily I had some good support because... my brother looked after him and took him to another festival that I loved going to in Taranaki. And I was working. I think I was running an all-women's bakery in Grey Lynn at the time. Vegetarian bakery, one of the first. So, yeah, back to normal life. But in the meantime, Jimmy had been so inspired by New Zealand and other things.
With a big smile on your face.
A big smile on my face that he put together a new band. Because without us knowing... At the time, that was the house band's last hurrah. They were splitting, and everyone was going their separate ways. Well, Jimmy, because that was his living, and they were all professional musicians then. Mm-hmm. I mean, they had a much bigger catchment. You know, they had the intensity of the population in the UK, very vibrant scene, just amazing amount of places to constantly play. Folk clubs were very active. So every week there would be, you know, clubs that had a a guest performer, and it wasn't huge money, but it was a livable amount of money. Plus, they had a whole European circuit, so the music was big, especially if you played Celtic music. The music was very big in Spain, Germany, in Scandinavia. All of them were doing over in Europe, and then Ireland, Scotland, UK. The festival scene there would go for the entire summer, so every weekend there was a wonderful festival, which they used to have amazingly big headlining guest lists, and they still do. He went away and created a trio called Rua. So that was the first incarnation of Rua, and that included Ian McLeod, who was in the house band with Jimmy, and another young, amazing player called Dave Robb, who again had the sparkling fast fingers playing bouzouki and singing. So they organised a follow-up and came out to New Zealand the following year and played at Fowey Flat. Yeah, so that was the beginning of my... I didn't play musically with Jimmy, but got to know each other. So and that was the beginning of that part of my life. And in the meantime, I was delving now because I'd listened to and took the house band album home and played it and played it and played it. So, and I still, of course, have my small selection of very special LPs. So that started me on a journey of listening out for and finding more traditional material and kind of, in a sense, educating myself. Because it's something that would have been in a lot of our family's early backgrounds before they immigrated to New Zealand.
Being born in Invercargill, what's your family history?
No music. And that's something that Jimmy and I talked about quite a lot once when we became a couple and I was part of Rua, and we did a lot of tours around New Zealand, and we had a lot of people that would come to us and up to us and ask and just say, there's something about your music that resonates. And so we figured out that we don't quite understand. We know there was some music back in the days that New Zealand was colonised, that they came up when they came over to pioneer and the Europeans settled here, but in a lot of ways a lot was left behind and it didn't continue here. And we thought about it and we talked about it, and we think because it came from a very strict structured system was how the UK operated, you know, in terms of the aristocracy, tenant farmers, what people could and couldn't do. They had their music, but when they had the opportunity to come to New Zealand, most of them were hoodwinked into what they were going to get here.
Right.
It wasn't anything like what had been advertised. They had a very hard life in this country.
Life was harder, and you didn't have time maybe.
Absolutely not. They had nothing when they got here, and they had to rebuild everything. So not a lot of time. They also had a lot of geographical difficulties in this country. Mm-hmm. There were no roads to get to here, there and everywhere. So they were a lot more isolated. The hard work. And the other thing we've thought about was possibly it was too much a reminder of home to play the music as well for the musicians that came here, I'm saying. So, and I'm talking about the traditional music. So we really, as a country, as a new country as well, colonised country, they didn't bring that with them. Whereas in Canada, Nova Scotia, they did. They took that music, and it's one of the things that musicologists find really fascinating is that the traditional music that the settlers took to Nova Scotia stayed pure to the tradition, in a sense, than it did staying back where it came from, back at home. The purity of the music remained in that area. That does happen
culturally in many places.
Yeah. So that was something that we realised about here. But one of the things, the other thing that was really just was, you had to really think about this and go, my goodness, we really are, in a lot of ways, the sum of our ancestors, the sum of our ancestors, you know, who was behind us in the past, how we come to be here.
So with Rua, at a certain point, there's this New Zealand influence that starts interweaving.
Yeah, Denny's influence.
Denny's influence, exactly. And so here we have you coming into this stew, basically.
Yeah, the stew.
This traditional stew.
Yeah.
And bringing in this whole other culture,
I guess so. I guess even though not thinking about it like that at the time, something afterwards that you look back and
but
go,
but it's an ancestral thing here as well.
Yeah, it was. So even though I didn't grow up with any traditional music. What we all probably grew up with, of people of my generation, so I was born in 1955, so all my formative years were in that wonderful deep southern town of Invercargill, and it was a very conservative place to live. However, my mother came from a very large Maori Irish Catholic family. And when I'm saying very large, my mum was a middle child of 15 children.
Wow.
My grandmothers were both alive, both amazing, strong women. My father came from a family of five, but mum came from 15. And, of course, many of the people in her family were musical because there's something about the Indigenous peoples as well that have a natural rhythm and they sang. So family gatherings with my mother's family always included lots of music and a few guitars, just strummed, but all had wonderful voices. So I grew up in Invercargill, very isolated from my mother's family, well, other than Christmases and visits. Mm-hmm. But my mum loved singing. So, and we all probably had, those of us that were from just okay enough backgrounds, the families all had radiograms. Now, does anyone remember a radiogram? The radiogram wasn't just a turntable. It was a piece of furniture. It was a statement. So if you were doing okay, in a sense, probably if there was a class thing, you'd be getting to middle class if we had that back then. But we didn't really know about it, and we didn't really think of anything like that.
You were just able to afford to get a radiogram.
And mum and dad, you would save. Back then, no one had credit cards or lay-bys or anything. You wanted something, you had to save for it. Mm-hmm. So I remember when the radiogram arrived in the lounge, you know, it was a piece of beautiful not mahogany, but some gorgeous timber, and it had glass sides for the booze, you know, and it was all done like the radio in the middle, and then you lifted up the lid and there was your turntable, and it had a place for the records. And the thing about that is, for me, my mum and dad were quite, this was in the earlier days of their marriage, they were pretty social. And so you're thinking, what am I thinking here? Early 60s, there probably weren't a lot of restaurants to go to. There were dancers. So people made their own entertainment, very much so. So I can remember a lot of gatherings at our house. It was quite a big house. Dad had built it. He was a builder. Built this open plan house, which was spectacular for the time. It took a lot of people really easily. Gatherings would occur, but people didn't really sing at them, but the music went on, all the albums.
Oh, yeah.
But my mum was into all of the popular music of the time. Now, there's nothing wrong with this, because they were great singers, and that was Pat Boone, Andy Williams, Connie Francis, who was my mother's favourite singer. So I grew up with a lot of really wonderful crooners.
And you can't help but take some of that.
Well, how can you not? Because all the musicians that are interviewed today, and the ones that are my age, you know, the Stings of this world and many others, recount similar experiences. Mm-hmm. It was the music that was played in the house, if you were lucky to have that, did influence you hugely. Mm-hmm. So by the time I was about 8 or 9, I was, and Cilla Black and Sandy Shaw and all the great divas of the 60s, I was singing away to my heart's content, and I'd go out into Dad's garage or the garden shed and pretend and sing, all to myself, you know.
No idea at this time that you would be on
stage. No, just because you loved
later.
It.
Yeah.
But you didn't know anything, you know what I mean? You just did it because it was there. And I remember my mother, and I still do this to this day, I hate housework, but I have to do it. I like having a nice, clean house, but I loathe the work that you have to do to get there. Mum always put music on when she was cleaning, and she would sing. And she'd sing on, there was a lot of the Broadway, the shows, you know, like The King and I, and what's the other one? South Pacific. So, and Oklahoma. So Mum would sing a lot of those songs. I remember one in particular, she'd waltz around with one of those ancient bloody vacuum cleaners, and it was I Feel Pretty. So that one, I'm not going to sing it.
Are you sure? You don't want to give me a line or
no,
two?
No, I don't want to give a line, because my mum, it was quite high. I don't do high anymore. And the other one was, I remember there was gorgeous, cute wee songs, and Doris Day.
Oh, right.
There was a gorgeous song, How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? So I grew up on Schmaltz Girl. So going back to what influence
but
I had.
It was the influence of the time, right? It was the music of the
time.
Yeah,
and I went the influence then when you say, well, the cultural side of the music, I guess, didn't change Rua, but it didn't. The essence of Rua was always in Jimmy. He was Rua to me and to most, but everyone really, because it was something about how he heard music, how he interpreted it, and the instruments he played. But so what I brought in was I did learn, and when you look at the CDs, the one I've got out is one of the first ones that we made as Rua. So it was called The Caves of the Sun, and we made this in Edinburgh. And one of the songs on here for me are pretty much all traditional. So in that intervening time that I hadn't seen Jimmy when he went back to Scotland, I was listening and searching and finding music.
Yeah. Something clicked in you.
Yeah, it did. And, well, that's what it did. It was that whole indescribable DNA thing that sometimes, or whatever it is in you that is locked because you don't know. Mm-hmm. There hasn't been strong oral history in your family, and there's so much you don't know. And I think that still happens a lot, you know. There's something about what he did and what they did in music that unlocked something that made me need to find out more. And I did that through music. And I also started asking a lot more questions around my family and talking to my mum, you know, about things that maybe I wouldn't have at that age. But this album here, The Caves of the Sun, all this, it's a mixture of, which was the style that you put out Celtic music when you had singers, is that you would do your sets of tunes, because that's totally how the music's done there, which you dance to. Then there'd be a song, then you'd do more tunes, and there'd be another song. So every one of these is traditional. But the one that really blew me away was The Death of Queen Jane, which is the track two. He brought that song to me because he would be listening and thinking, what will work with how I sing? And I've always been like this right from the very beginning, even though I might have grown up on pop songs and there was a lot of slushy lyrics. As you grow older, you get a little more, you get pickier. But I always had a thing about good quality, good writing. I needed to, if I was going to put myself out there, like, you know, it's a vulnerable place being, opening your mouth and singing and having people listen.
Yeah, and you're the interpreter.
You're the interpreter of those words. And so it was always really important to me that it was good writing. I feel happy now looking back at all of the choices, that it was all good writing. And particularly I loved when Jimmy wrote as well. And so when he brought me this song, Queen Jane, the Death of Queen Jane, it was like, God almighty. It's a story, and it's a true story, of one of King Henry VIII's wives, how she died in childbirth and child labour. And it's a story that repeats itself throughout history. Well, and it continues. Young women, very young, being married off to older gentlemen for political reasons, for reasons of gaining more wealth for the family. Now, I learned about all of that through the music. So what it did was it sort of fed a love of history, an interest in history, learning, really, getting right down to more like a social history of how life was like for women. It was never a good place to be for a female. But the caesarean, he talks about ripping open her womb, her baby, taking the baby out. And I remember saying to Jimmy, what's this line about? He says, that's a caesarean. And I remember being like, what?
How insightful for a male as well.
Very.
Yeah.
But that was a particular thing that I found that I was really attracted to in him as a human being. Yeah, he was the least macho man that I've ever met in my life, actually. And then, but that's another whole story, because I'd of course learned by being with him for 30 years, marrying him, I learned all about his childhood and his family history, which basically, you know, helped make him the man he was.
Sure.
And it was really interesting because a lot of people, we had a particular stage banter on stage, and it took me a while to figure it out, because he was from the west of Scotland, they had a particular humour And for a long time, I didn't understand it. And we used to have communication problems.
Is this through the whole 30 years of marriage?
Yeah. Oh, no. In the end, we didn't. But in the early years of being married, we were very, very much in tune and in love. And he was my soul connection. But we didn't mean to say that we saw everything the same. And we would have some difficulties in communicating. And we could talk, and we'd have big, long conversations around everything, not just music. But he was very important. And you probably think, Denny, don't talk so much about Jimmy, but he was so much part of me musically and my musical growing and development. And what we see here is just a selection of music that we've made that will be there beyond us.
Yeah, so I'm looking at this pile of CDs here, and I mean all of the Rua CDs and the other collaborations with other New Zealand artists that included Jimmy as well, and
yep,
so many of them.
Yeah.
And so you can't help but talk about your life, your musical essence, without weaving in Jimmy's story.
I mean, he
as
wasn't
well.
The only one, because I'd been playing and loving the music before I met him,
yeah,
and there's a little bit there we could go back and talk about. I guess people will have picked up, and you've picked up certainly, how influential he was. But when I talk about the communication, I'll tell you what it was, because some people, as we changed, as the decades went through, and there was changes in female-male scenarios in terms of equality and us getting better, what's the word? Feminism came, and I mean, you've got to remember when we'd met, it was in the 80s, and there was a lot of change, and things were, you know, being shaken up quite mm-hmm. strongly. But in terms of, he was never like a lot of the other men that I'd ever met in my life, or like my father, or the male role models I had. And I think that was one of the things that really made me attracted to him as a person. He had a deep, deep connection to the earth, to the planet, to the land, to what's beyond. Like, he was a very spiritual man in his own way, and yet had been brought up in that extremely and it has always been in Ireland and Scotland, you're a Protestant or a Catholic, and you are raised that way, you are educated in that, you were not expected to marry outside of your religion, they were separate. It was separatism, and New Zealand wasn't quite like that. There was a little bit of it, but in general we were far more open.
Less population, you had to
work together
and work,
a lot more. And mm-hmm. the religious fervour would have been here in some parts. And I know that there's still pockets of New Zealand very much that were Catholic or Baptist or, you know, whatever. And I'm not saying that didn't play a part here, but it was structure in Scotland and Ireland. Absolutely. And he left, and maybe, I don't know whether that was part of it or not, but he loved being able to just be who he was here, that he wasn't characterised by a religion or the way he had been brought up. He was just Jimmy.
You can reinvent yourself when you go someplace.
Well, you know this. Well, the thing about the communication was, this was something that we figured, and I think you might relate to this too. You're English speaking. We're English speaking people. In every way you would think, well, so is the UK, so is Ireland, so is Scotland. Yes, they have a native language, an indigenous language, mm-hmm. but at that point when I met him, that was just starting to come through, like we are trying to do here in New Zealand with Te Reo, where there was a movement to bring the language back into a living situation again. So we've met, we're together on all these many different levels and things, but we would have this communication problem sometimes, and I'd look at him and go, what are you trying to say, or what are you trying to tell me, what is it? And he'd go, I've just told you, or there would be a way that he was in the humour, and it took me a long time, and not till I actually moved and lived in Scotland with Jim that I started to see it. Scotland's very much divided into coasts, a little bit like New Zealand, east and west. Okay, so yeah. Edinburgh, east coast, Glasgow, further inland, but west coast. Oh. there's a huge amount of difference between those two, the two sides. Yeah. Like, and as the further north you go, the same thing occurs. And when your ear is attuned to it, you'll listen, or anyone that's from there or who knows a culture will know that there's so many variants in the accent. I can pick an East Scots accent now, which blows them away. They go, how can you do that? Well, I was married to a West Coast Scotsman, for a very long time. So that helped develop my ear. But the humour, it was the humour. And one of the things that I didn't understand, which, as I said, was a problem, we worked through it and got there eventually, was that in where he comes from, which is Dumbarton, just outside of Glasgow, they were very working class. They were on the Clyde River, and his father worked on the ships, the same as Billy Connolly, same era. Mm. It was a hard life, and so everything they did was hard. They drank hard. They worked hard. They swore hard. When they told stories, they were hard. And so when they loved someone, they were hard on you. It wasn't all lovey-dovey, gorgeous stuff, called slagging. So you would have heard that expression?
Not really.
No. You're being slagged off?
No, that's kind of a new expression.
Okay,
for me.
Well, this is part of my vocabulary.
Okay.
Now, like a lot of Scots words are, but yeah, you're slagged. Now, not only are you slagged off by your partner, but when you go and you stay with the partner's family, you're just part of the family. You're now part of the family.
Yeah.
So they all slag off at you. Now, what that is it's kind of quite difficult to explain what it is. You have to hear it and see it. But it's like they'll find your Achilles heel and they'll press your buttons all the time. But what you don't know, if it isn't what you've grown up with, if it isn't what you know, you think they're being serious. But it's their very strange way of showing you that they love you. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, it must be, obviously, in general, a very cultural...
Totally. They can say so many honest things to your face that we would never in a million years dream of saying. Mm-hmm. It's like the lid goes off and all your foibles are out there for full exposure, and they will nail you. They'll do it in a particularly... it's just a Scottish way. Yeah. I can't even describe what it is.
Did you, when that was happening, especially when you first got together and you've got this dynamic going on, did you fight that? Did you go, this is so anti?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, totally. It wasn't my world.
Yeah.
My world, well, actually coming from Invercargill even worse, is like, and leaving Invercargill, it's like, you leave Invercargill behind and you know, it's like you become someone else. It's like, it was almost embarrassing to say I was from Invercargill when I was a young woman in Auckland, because it was the hicks. It was the stick.
We'll back up a little bit. So coming from Invercargill, what drove you to Auckland?
Oh, my family went there. My family travelled. My father left Invercargill with us when I was about 13.
And other kids in your family?
My brother. Yeah, I have a brother. Yeah. And that was for his own sanity and actually trying to save his marriage. So my father put us on a boat. Mm-hmm. I was 12 years old and sailed across the world against the tide to the UK when all the £10 UKers were coming over to New Zealand. Mm. That's an interesting thing. You're pretty good at this, you know. But because I've always been outside the circle. I've always felt like I'm on the fringe. I've always never quite been in the group. I've always been outside cliques and cliques, or whatever you want to say. I've always felt myself a little bit of an observer and never in the mainstream. Well, why would you think I would be like that? Well, there's one reason. I'm 12 years old, going to a little school in Invercargill, where my mother has got 6 weeks' notice. My father has bought tickets on a huge Greek liner, leaving Auckland in 6 weeks, and we are moving to the UK. I can remember exactly what he said to her. He said, he was a builder, worked hard, came home and said to her, do you think you could get the house packed up in 6 weeks? And she goes, you know, what? Mm-hmm. Well, she had no choice because Dad had bought the tickets. We weren't quite in steerage on the boat, but we weren't certainly in the big flash cabins. And we spent 6 weeks on this massive ocean liner full of non-English-speaking Greek people who were the staff going across the world to arrive in Southampton. I look at it now, and I have done over the years, thinking, what an extraordinary thing to do. No one else did it. You didn't do that. But my husband did the same thing. Jimmy did the same thing. All of Jimmy's family still, and those that are still living, still live in the town they were brought up in.
I always think there's generally like one in the family that just has something in them that there's a reason why I have to travel, I have to go somewhere else.
Yeah.
And it, what it does is it changes the dynamic.
Adventurers,
that's right.
Yeah, well, I guess that was what my father was. And it was very hard. When we got there, it wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. We were aliens. It was the time in my life where I felt most alienated. And you, I guess, when you look at it, you think, well, you have to just get through it. You know, you, like everyone does in adversity, you've got to, you sink or swim, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, it was a bit of both, a bit of sinking and a bit of swimming, especially going into a London Church of England high school with segregated staircases, like for boys and girls, and we had to call the teachers masters, and they wore black robes like you see in Harry Potter and wear hats on their heads. I mean, I didn't know. That would have been very instrumental in making me the person, or starting that thing of making you the adult you become without me knowing it. But, and I think one, it's quite weird, isn't it? You're probably thinking, well, why are we talking about music? But all those experiences create who you are and determine, in a sense, what you seek yourself.
Yeah.
Don't they?
They do. And I think this is going exactly where it should be going. You know, we're talking about your legacy here, and it's not just a musical legacy. You know, life is a, you know, legacy. Each one of us is important. We are important to the body of our communities, but we're also important to our families. And
we don't often get asked about our story, do we?
Yeah, that's right.
So this is a very special and unique situation to be in. And I remember when you asked me, when you finally tracked me down, because I've sort of put myself into a slightly, oh well, not slightly, a deliberate hibernation because of other factors to do with earthquakes and Christchurch and things, and also losing Jimmy. Now I've been without him for like 4 years, you know, because he's gone. And I've struggled quite a lot with a lot of that. And it's altered my life story again in a huge way. And so just you asking me to do this, I was really both touched and surprised, I suppose, when you talked about legacy, because I never, it is just something that's been part of my life. You don't think about, you just don't think about it in their sort of terms, you know?
Well, you have a daughter.
And a son.
Mm. Yeah.
I have a son and a daughter, and I have three Mokopuna, three grandchildren.
Yeah. And there's probably things that you're telling me that, you know,
they may not know. Even though you try, we've always, Jimmy and I always raised our kids with stories.
Mm-hmm.
We weren't a family that sat around and just watched TV every night. We did things. Jimmy wanted Grace to be really able to, like, he loved football, absolute football man. Got me into football, so we would watch the World Cups and things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he made sure that she did things like he'd be out in the back garden with her from a wee girl with a football, you know, doing kicks and. And we told stories. We shared a lot of stories around the dinner table, and we'd play games the table.
And are your kids musical?
In a sense, it was a difficult one. We had many discussions about this.
Mm-hmm.
I listened to his playing, and other people would agree with this. He transcended normal sounds.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy created something that was a very, very special that I don't think could be replicated in the way he played his traditional instruments, how he adapted them. Mm-hmm. Like, he rebuilt the pipes. They don't sound like anybody else's Northumbrian pipes.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I first heard the real ones, I went, what? No, Jimmy, they're not. Yes, they are. And funnily enough, it wasn't Jimmy who really, I learnt about how he did it, but it was Davy Stewart, who was also became part of Rua, New Zealand Rua, a couple of years ago, gave me the whole story of how Jimmy pushed out the envelope with the makers of his pipes, who had never done what he asked either. He expanded an instrument with a tiny range, which were always played in F. Now, that's not a singer's key, right? It's not a guitarist's key either.
It's not a really, it's a horrible key.
And he changed them. There was something about the pipes that he loved, because they're done with the bellows, not with blowing, so they're a quieter pipe. But he heard things, and he got the makers, two different makers in the UK, to develop different chanters, which are the keys to go on the pipes that no one else did.
Okay.
So he could play in B-flat. For all the singers out there and musicians, B-flat they always called it my key. In B-flat. Yeah. It's a beautiful key to sing in, and it's my key, because it's sort of like ballad. It fits well. But we've all got a key we tend to find as singers that is our key. But there'll be one or two. There'll be variations. You can't sing everything the same.
Yeah, you can move a bit in there, but you're going to have your sweet spot.
The sweet spot, yeah, Lynette, that's exactly right. What it was. So he has, honestly, I'd love to do a program just on him with people like Davy Stewart about what Jimmy's legacy in itself is, with an instrument that's ancient. No one else has done it. And with our children, my son, because he was Jimmy was his stepfather, and it became his father. Wonderful ear for music, and our daughter the same. The music, they find music. They they're the ones that channel like different music to their friends, like who've no idea about this, but it would be Joshua or Grace who finds this wonderful other music. So growing up with us opened up their ears and their hearts to music of all kinds. Because I have to say, even though, yes, I brought the ballad section into Rua, going right back to that earlier question, when you said about the cultural kind of, well, it was a cultural marriage in a sense.
Yeah.
I could not authentically only do Irish and Scottish traditional music, I felt, because there were so many real Irish and Scottish singers.
So it sounds like there was a real bridge. Jimmy had this vision when it came to the pipes and idea of lowering the key, and creating something so that here you are with your beautiful pipes, your own pipes, able to come in and create something very special.
And with the singer. Which was a very difficult, which was really impossible, because Northumbrian players just did not do that. Yeah. And they tended to play ensemble music, old stuff. Beautiful in its own right, but not something that you would could make a living at or play in festivals and things. It was something, and how he managed how he did that was again what he was hearing in his head. He got over all the practical obstacles and worked with the makers about how to make this work.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say going, so in that sense with Rua and the development of Rua over like 25 years doing the concerts and the tours and making the albums, we created this partnership where it was great trust, and with our band members, everyone brought music to the table. Sometimes we had things that didn't work, but we'd all know. In rehearsal, we'd all know if it was going to go somewhere or whether it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't give up easily, because if we found something we loved, we would give it our best shot. Most of the things worked, What we found, though, was that what we chose to put together in the sets of tunes, not of all of which were fast and speedy. There would be different tempos. The slow air that would be played that would just wrench your heart. And then the combination of the songs that we would all bring to the table. They weren't just all my selections. Mm-hmm. Sometimes Jimmy would find something, and then I would be searching, so would Davey, and we'd all have something to add.
Davey Stewart.
Yeah. But generally I was always, there she goes again, she's in B-flat, and I won't swear, but it's a bloody slow ballad. Then. And they eventually came to the conclusion that I wasn't any good at singing fast stuff. And I came to that conclusion too, so I'll tell you in a little secret, because I know that you're going to splice in some tracks, Lynette.
Yes, definitely.
Is that when you listen to some of the slower things, what we did, it was clever. Man, it was clever. It took a while. But that was me. That personified me as a singer, as a communicator. I don't know what it was. It was about the words, or it might have been about, I don't know why, but anyway, that's what I could do. I never felt that I did a good job of lots of fast material.
It didn't resonate with
Not even necessarily that. Maybe it was just too many words in a phrase.
Mm.
Anyway, that's another thing I have to go away and think about
after today, actually.
This became a signature. So Jimmy's pipe sound was a signature that a lot of people don't even know about. Northumbrian pipes are made in Northumbria, in the north of England. That's where they come from. There might have been one or two people playing them in New Zealand when Jimmy came. There's probably quite a few more people playing them, but I feel quite okay to say this because I know you can edit this out.
Yeah.
They're very difficult to play and they're very difficult to keep in tune, on track, because they're reeds. They're little, like clarinets and piccolos. They're a reed blown instrument.
Must be an incredibly expensive instrument to play as well.
Yep. To have a set of pipes made would cost quite a lot of money, mm-hmm. because they're hand turned and they have pieces. You know, the keys. Some of the keys that are flattened on a hole are made of solid silver. So there's something that increases, like good musical instruments across the board, mm. they increase in value. Mm. Probably not massively, but they're not something that ever goes down. So they're a legacy for our children, mm-hmm. His instruments.
Yeah.
For me, I know that they're just full of Jimmy's DNA in every yeah. way. They're such a personal part of someone's being, for someone like him. And with our kids, we just decided that we could easily have stuck. We could have plonked Grace into a Suzuki method at four, age four, learning the violin. We could have done all, but we didn't. We decided not to. We made a conscious decision that we were not going to hothouse in any way our kids, force them into music. We felt that if there was music that they needed to make, create, do, they would find it. But we would give them every opportunity for anything that they chose they'd like to have a go at. So that's what we did. Joshua had a bit of a go, on this and a bit of a go at that. That's what he calls himself. He says, I'm just a bit of a mum. But his love of music and listening and sharing music's immense. And that's passing on through my grandchildren. And with my daughter, the interesting thing with that one is, our daughter, Grace, is that she's just a little genius. Everything she picked up made me sick. I struggle to play an instrument because I think my voice has always been the number. It's been easy until now, everyone. Get to your mid-60s and it isn't so easy. You need to learn to retire gracefully. Yeah, some people are just born with this intuitive way of understanding and knowing how to play an instrument. She has it in spades. Where does that come from? I'm not going to say it's from us.
Right.
She would just... look, when she was seven, and her bedroom was on the other side, we lived in an old villa house with a hallway, and we'd have many rehearsals in our big lounge. Her bedroom was over the other side. She needed to go to the toilet at 7. She would just come out through the door, walk through the entire band. There's instruments all over the floor. There's pipes. There's everything going on 2 and 3 times a week often. This was her life growing up.
Yeah.
Do you know what that was for her? It was just normal. It was every day at home. Mm-hmm. It wasn't special or unique or anything. It was just what it was.
Yeah. So did the kids go on tour? Did they?
Yes, all of them. Tour? All of them came with us. I look back now and go, how the hell did we ever do that? But you know, because that's why you're doing this whole amazing series of this, is that when something has to happen, when you're moved to do this, you just make it happen.
You find ways. Yeah, that's right.
You know, so listen, we did concerts and things at the Christchurch Folk Club with our daughter in a little tiny sleeping bag tucked underneath the pool table. And I don't think that she'd ever say that she had a difficult child rearing. Yeah. It was just what you did. And that reminds me, when I was a kid, going right back, you know, when I said mum and dad would have gatherings in the house, mm-hmm. I'm sure that resonates with a lot of people that are in my decade, growing up. Born 50s, growing up in the 60s, it was a gentler time. There wasn't the stresses. There wasn't a lot of things that people have to deal with today were not there. We didn't have all that technology and the speed of things. Things were slower. And actually, if you lived in Southland, the southern part of New Zealand, they were slower even then. I've often remarked with the times we toured down there how everything slows down the further south you go. Almost used to drive into a time warp, a lovely time warp. It's not a negative comment. It's a positive comment because I've got amazing memories of my childhood and just how it was. But I also remember, and this is when we're saying, well, what happened with your kids when you're touring and you're doing things? You make things happen. But I also remember now, you've just brought this straight up, being wrapped up in one of those pink and blue check blankets, the New Zealand Woolen Mills blanket, bundled up in a car, pre-seat belts. Off we'd be going as a family to someone's evening. Everyone did it. You took the kids. Because we were also brought up to be seen and not heard. Yes, you had to be very quiet. Mm-hmm. You were allowed, the quieter you were, the longer you would be allowed to stay up sitting in the corner or behind the sofa watching what the adults were doing.
Sure.
So what did you do? You didn't make a ruckus or get in the way or be demanding. Mm-hmm. You wanted to see what they were getting up to. So you were as quiet as mouse. Mm-hmm. And if you were really lucky and you were awake, you'd get some supper. And the supper time was fantastic.
It was a party.
It was a party, yeah. And the suppers were huge. Everybody, ladies a plate. I said to Jimmy, I always wanted him to write a tune called Ladies a Plate, because that's what you did. And it's okay, because that's what it was. It was called that, Ladies a Plate. I can't remember what the men had to do. Men did something. Oh, men with the bottle. The men bring the bottle, the ladies a plate. And the suppers were incredible. And I can remember the 50s. I can remember the late 50s. I've got memories going. I can remember, like, back to being four. And you didn't have a lot. That wasn't about things. Yeah. And what we had was, which is so, I find very sad today, we had a freedom that we didn't know about. I feel like crying about this, Lynette. It's so changed today for parents and children. Is that we knew everyone on our street. Everyone. I knew every child on our street. And so when you were little, like 3 and 4, it was okay. You'd go out in your little tricycle. They had a little tray on the back. All the neighbours knew you. You'd go up and you could bike up and see Mrs. Sconson, or whatever her name was, and they'd give you a pikelet. No one worried that something awful would happen. So I'm not saying awful things didn't happen, because I know occasionally something awful did happen, but because the media wasn't all everywhere, you weren't absolutely surrounded by everything that's going on in the world.
You still had an innocence.
There was
a child.
Thank you. That's the word. It's an innocence. That you had an innocence in your growing up that I don't know that our children today have ever had. They've had. I know that Jimmy and I made a very conscious effort to keep media and all things technological out of our home family life. And I know that by the time our kids both got to 12 and 13, they hated us, because we didn't bow to pressure. We said no. We said no to every gaming console. We said no to SingStar. We said no, no, no. When my daughter was 8 years old, going to primary school in Christchurch, her friends had the early cell phones at 8. We said no. So it is a choice that you make as parents, but we both grew up with that sense of freedom and innocence, where our neighbourhood was our backyard. And your mum or your dad, mostly your mum, would call at 6 o'clock for you to come in, whichever house you were playing at or whatever. And we played games that went on for weeks. You know, we'd create these amazing imaginative games where they would go on, and couldn't wait to get home from school and park the bike and grab the cake tin, because we all grew up with mothers who baked and filled the tins with homemade food, and go out and carry on our game.
Community, though, wasn't
it? It was community. We used to do shows. My entire childhood till I left Invercargill, I can remember, we roller skated. And it was the very early years of concrete driveways. My dad was a builder, so we had an amazing white concrete driveway. It was amazing. And everyone roller skated. And we would put on bloody, our poor parents, when I think about it, we'd put on these bloody shows. You know, we would do a bit of practice and we'd get together and we'd dress up in sort of curtains and God knows what. and then we'd get our mothers to do baking and everything, and we'd make little leaflets and we'd invite the neighbourhood to our shows that we were making up as we went along. I mean, honestly, when I think about it.
Precursors to There You Are on Stage.
Well, you know, didn't know, did I?
No, no.
So, God, I have to thank you for reminding me of my own, the legacy of my parents and my community, really.
And you talk about it, and I see there's a lot of joy in your eyes as you're talking about it.
I didn't, because, you know, one of the things that can happen as you age, We're all aging. When you get to a certain kind of age and you see what's going on, you're very much aware of what's happening around the destruction and the lack of peace. We won't even get into the climate change. Everything is sitting on a precipice. I think I hadn't really delved back into where I came from. Yeah. All I would say is, and you said this to me earlier when I said something to you about plants, is that I prefer plants to people because I've really enjoyed this, by the way. This time has just flown by so fast. Yes. We've hardly talked about bloody music, but I can't get away from that. But you're right. It's like so much of who you are, where you've come from, the people who brought you here, your whānau, your family, your ancestors that came before are all part of what you give out and what is, and sometimes you don't realise it, you don't know it. It's not until maybe you put in a position, and it's lovely to be asked, so that this is my memory's just kind of opening up the more we talk. I didn't prepare. I had a wee worry last night thinking maybe I need to find some stuff that I've got stuffed away so I can remember dates and things, but it's not really been needed.
Lights on the west we go. A million cars hurry home. An ice cream van turns off its tinsel bells. Winter won't be long. I see you every day. I watch as you walk by this way and pause on the stairs of this council block, too shy to find words to say. And your smile is a prayer that prays for love, and your heart is a kite that longs to fly. Alleluia, here I am. Let's cut the string.
This whole collaboration, it's marriage, everything, it completely encompassed so much of your life.
Well, it did, and you know something else that's just popped up?
Yeah.
We were both latecomers to exposing ourselves out there in the world of music with other people. He was lanced in the heart by hearing something on BBC Two Radio with the famous John Peel show. And I'll tell you what it was. It was hearing the Chieftains for the first time, who are a legendary, seminal Irish band of about 10 musicians of all the traditional Irish music. Now, a lot of people will know who the Chieftains are. Those that haven't, well, their legacy is just incredible. It's massive, worldwide, amazing. So when he first heard that on radio, it did something to him. And he went from nothing musically, no music growing up in his house, no live music. But again, he loved music. And one of the first things he did when he was a paperboy at 13 was go out and buy himself a turntable, a little portable one, and buy music, buy singles and listen to it. I was very much the same as that. Mm-hmm. And I didn't come to music to like other people start singing out loud and starting to learn and develop and play until I was in my mid to late 20s, and neither did he. We weren't 15, 16.
Did he play by ear?
Totally.
Yeah, and you sing by ear.
Yep.
Yeah.
Both of us subsequently learned to read music. Uh-huh. For me, it was always like maths, and I was never really very good at maths. You know, my subjects were language.
So at a certain point, you said, you know what, in order to take it somewhere else, I want to learn a little bit of the underlying.
Yeah, and a lot of that you pick up. Mm-hmm. When you're playing, when you're doing a lot of music, you just ceases to be a foreign language, because you look at written music, and if you're not trained and you don't go to music lessons and you don't learn what that is, it can just look like total foreign language to you. Once you make that breakthrough and realize that it's only seven notes.
And you had hours of this. I mean, so many practices.
Yeah.
So many.
And everyone shares. That's the other thing. No one I ever met in music, and I think I was very lucky with this, because it may not always be the case. Everyone that, and maybe that's who you draw into you, were giving and open to sharing what they knew. And I that's a great way of learning. And I'm one of those learners. I'm not a learner. You know how you have all the different types of learning?
Yeah.
I do need to go over and over things, but to go over and over with music's not really it's not a chore. And Jimmy taught himself. And that's because he learnt so many, and he's got something that's been left and that I have to do something about. He has left a legacy of thousands of written Scottish and Irish tunes that have not been published. And he wrote them all out by hand.
Wow.
From his ear. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He was just incredibly special musically and a lovely, lovely man, and has made a massive impact. You know, my life would not be what it's been had we not met, had we not for some reason been at that same festival.
You've made an impact on New Zealand music, Danny, and we shouldn't forget that, because this is why you're here. And obviously Jimmy is a big part of that. But as I go through this catalog of CDs and, you know, so much music, to take this catalog and look at everything that you've been involved in the New Zealand scene, it's huge. And
I never saw it like that, though. I've never seen it like that.
But yeah, but it's funny. So, you know, obviously, people listening to this can't see what I'm seeing in front of me, but there's a stack of CDs that have your imprint on them, and you know, I mean, I'm just looking here. You know, there's the Rua CDs. There's a Christchurch folk club CD that you helped put together. You were part of the not only the folk club, but a folk club
president. I was on the committee at this point. Yeah. So going right back to that period, folk clubs.
Yeah.
Massive training grounds, and all volunteers, always operated by people who are passionate about music.
I got into music because of the folk club scene.
Go back pre-earthquake situation here.
Yeah.
But everywhere, really, and being asked things, is that I've always said to people out there, I don't know why the word folk is such a dirty word.
Right.
In the broad general sense of music. For many years, I was a judge in the New Zealand Music Awards. Now, while you're a judge of that, you can't tell anyone you're a judge, so you remain anonymous. The difficulty with that was, and I pulled out and wrote a letter at the same time, is that you know everyone that's coming into your category. Mm-hmm. And it would be the same for everyone if they categorise music into these blocks. Okay, so New Zealand folk, New Zealand country, New Zealand, but always generally, of course, none of those genres ever get, it's now the Vodafone Music Awards, that's what it's called now, but it was the New Zealand music. But I suppose it's always been about the popular music, the radio hits.
Right.
You know, and we've had some amazing successes, haven't we, in the last decade, with people like Lord, and there's some big names out there that are international now from New Zealand. Now, I don't think you would have saw that coming in the 1970s, 80s. Right. But what I always saw was, and always felt, is that we had musical power and equal prowess when I was learning, and that was in the 70s and 80s. We had people who were writing songs that were as good as anything that was on the radio. They were as good as the people that became legends, and there was nowhere to go. We were so little. We were so in our own wee geographical bubble. We also had no support in arts and music in New Zealand from, there was no under swell. It was way before there was a quota on New Zealand radio.
Right.
There was no quota. So New Zealand music hardly got played. So the average punter out there listening would be listening to an international playlist everywhere else in the world. New Zealand musicians and music writers, it became its own underground, in a sense, scene.
Yeah.
There were always passion. There was always passionate listeners. There was always passionate players. But it never broke through into being mainstream when much of it should have.
Thousands of people
at a Furry Flat Festival in 1985.
And yet that didn't translate to radio play.
No, it didn't translate to any opportunities in our media, which New Zealanders looked at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Our dread, when you look back over archives of New Zealand, NZBC music programs on TV, they're excruciating in their... and the way they were presented. They were all copies of... They were popular singers singing copies of hits that were being made in the UK and Britain and the US. But in the same time, there was this whole world bubbling away underneath mm-hmm. of people like Mahina Rangitoka, whose song My Love Be Still is on the Toru CD, which was the last... CD.
That was your last CD.
That, not the Wayne Gillespie one, but that Toru one.
2017?
Yeah. She it was a huge influence on me and so many people in the 1980s, and she wrote an incredible song, which I told you about when we went to see Jan.
That's Jan Hill-Regal.
Yeah. It was the 80s then. She's written an amazing song about what it was like being a person, being a woman, being anyone growing up in the 80s. And she just nails it, absolutely. And it's got a fantastic chorus. You know, like she was an out there performer and had a major. I mean, she was just a startling genius, poet, incredible player, broke the boundaries of where you went on a guitar. I was in awe of her. And when she wanted to be my friend, I didn't know why, because it was like, oh my God, you're just a goddess. You're a goddess. And she would come and visit me, and I got over that eventually, but in a little way there was still a tiny bit of that when we all worked on this project with her, which was Jimmy, myself, James Wilkinson, Shona Lang. She chose what she called it was her dream team. She
had this vision. The mongrel in me.
She was a total visionary.
Wow.
She influenced so many people in music today. If you talk to a lot of performers that are doing well today.
But yet again, not popular music.
Not in the so-called
popularized music. So-called popular music.
Yeah. But what you do find, can I say, as a positive, this might be a great way of refinishing this one, is that they made albums, you know. Most of all these wonderful people did make albums.
One day I woke to find everything is worth a while. These few seconds closer to perfection. My love, my love. Be still. Once I loved a heart, but not as sweet as yours. Your body paints my memory with obsession. My love, my love, be still. Away.
Acoustic Confusion, the band, my very first band that I was in, and absolutely loved. We all loved it. It was easy. It was music that just flowed out of us.
Yeah.
Anyway, we made this album called Hazy Days. And this is just a very pathetic little homemade CD. It's that classic DIY thing New Zealanders still wonderfully have in our DNA.
And that was your very first product.
Yeah, but listen to how we did this. we were gaining momentum, and we had some serious fans, and we were doing concerts around various amazing venues in Auckland at the time. So we all lived in Auckland. We'd all met through the University Folk Club. This is something you didn't know about, which is long since gone. And that was the folk club. There were about four operating in Auckland through that time. Some of them had been going for a long, long time. The Bunker, the famous Bunker up in Devonport, on top of Mount Victoria, has just celebrated something like 40 or 50 years of being the folk club. And if anyone is in Auckland on a Monday night and wants to just experience a totally New Zealand, nothing to be repeated like anything else in the world experience. But there was Poles Apart, which is now gone, which was very much part of the folklore of New Zealand. There were several others, but I don't know how I got there, but I ended up at the University Folk Club, Auckland University, and it seemed to be where the contemporary players were going once a week, and it would just be like floor spots, and a floor spot would just be where they'd open it up and people would write their name down and get up and play. Well, I'll tell you what, it was so worth going there, because just about every week you were shot out of your seat by talent. By pure, amazing, and this is where collaboration started, and this is how Acoustic Confusion got together. Mm. We all saw each other individually there. I don't even know if I sang for ages. I just used to go up there because for some reason, and I think it might have been I discovered Joni Mitchell when I was about 14, way beyond, none of my contemporaries heard her. Everyone was into the Beatles. I discovered Joni, and I fell in love with the acoustic guitar, just the sound. So
she plays with a lot of open
tunings. It was the open tunings as well. So that, in a sense, led me there. And then we all met, and it was just like, Jesus, this is amazing. Then we were doing concerts in some very interesting, cool venues that were opening up by more passionate people who wanted to, open up stages for everything. For small theatre, for comedy, for every kind of performing art. And they were just independents like we were. We were all, that was the other thing. There was no backups. There was no one funding anyone. Yeah. This was all independent. All self-motivated, all self-sufficient. We were all broke. You know, no money got built up. So we were so broke, we couldn't afford to pay for doing an album. Everyone kept asking, because we did a lot of songs that they loved and would want us to sing. Yep. So Chris Priestley, who has gone on to have a much bigger profile or other profiles, running amazing cafes, he was one of the founders of Real Groovy Records, and he runs the music at Cafe 121 in Ponsonby to this day, came up with this great idea. And it's like what people do today. Now, here we are. 2020.
Yeah.
2020. And what's the way people do fundraising today?
GoFundMe page, you know. Yes.
Crowdfunding. Well, guess what? This little CD, this LP, we crowdfunded. I can't even read the date without my glasses.
1980-something.
Early 1980s. 1984. He came to us and said, I've got this idea. We want to make an album, right? But we all knew. It was like deciding you're going to go and climb Mount Everest, but you've got no backup. You've got no team. You've got no money. Well, how are we going to do this? So he said, well, this is my idea. We're going to pre-sell the album. We can't even book a studio. Yeah. But let's see how many pre-sales we get where people cough up all the money. $15 at the time was the average price, in a sense, but it was $15 for us to go and record, mix, create, pay for the LP, do the artwork, do the album. We had to get quite a lot of money together. We did it, in an extraordinarily short time. So then, to make the process of recording even cheaper, we went to Garden City Studios, I think it was, run by Steve Garden, who'd never heard of us. We booked a midnight to dawn session, because that was the cheapest recording rates. we went in there and we said to him, we have to do this live. Well, no, you can't do that. No one does albums live. You've all got to do it separate in these little booths, and we give you headphones. And you said, it's not going to work like that. So the only way that we could do it, because it was the money too. We had to put this down. I don't know how many tracks are there. It's quite a few. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And you go in tight because you've been working.
Well,
with
we
each
had to.
Other.
There was 10. Yeah. There's 10 songs on this. We did 10 songs in that 6 hours. In the night, the whole of the city is quiet, and we're in this very cool studio because all the big guns were using Steve Garden. He was a very well-known drummer. He'd never heard us before, got us in there. Yeah. The only separation we had to do was in some parts we had to put Brendan on harmonica, not in another room, but just using some baffle walls because of the intensity and the frequencies of his harmonica.
Mm-hmm.
We did it live. And then we had to sit together when it was all made, and we hand-stuck on all the centre labels of the LP, you know, the centre labels?
Yeah.
We hand-licked them. Licked them and stuck them on. And for everyone who owns an LP, and I know some people do still have them, we had to hand do them. The reason they're funny colours is we couldn't afford full colour printing, so we did the two colours. The picture on the front, I love this album, by the way. I'm very proud of what we did here.
How classic is it?
We were able to afford two colour. Chris's wife at the time took this amazing photo, which was an accident. It was a double exposure of the loss of an incredible, elaborate Victorian building in the centre of the city, reflected in the modern building of glass.
Incredible. I hadn't noticed that before.
No, you really noticed it. I'll show you on the album. Because it's the full size.
Wow.
So then we had to get together several evenings, and we hand stuck the photos on every LP cover.
Wow.
And Brendan Power hand wrote the sleeve notes, all of them, hand wrote. We photocopied them, but we hand wrote. That was a true independent creation that we did with very early historical crowdfunding before the use of the internet.
I love that. I love this story.
And do you know what this spawned, what came out of this?
So what did it spawn?
A whole lot of albums that other people decided they could make because we'd done it. And some of them did the same thing.
And it's about creating community.
So I love how you brought that back to that sense of community, because it was another community.
I see the rain outside my window.
A new garden since the earthquake. I just call it sanctuary. It's an unexpected garden, and it's somewhere when people are fed, when the odd visitor comes through, don't expect to see, because it's a little bit of a secret. Not necessarily that I've decided that it is a secret. It just is what it is. It's just become that. But I've repurposed many things to create this garden.
Mm-hmm.
I've also done it by spending very little money and being resourceful, and I think that's something that's come out of the disaster that has changed lives for many people here in Christchurch and Canterbury.
Yeah.
And I talk about Canterbury because it's where I live, but I know that it echoes with the more recent events through New Zealand, that it does. That's another journey that you go through, because you can't avoid it unless you just pick up sticks and leave.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talked about the fact that we're not rootless, that we are rooted, we connect to everything. I still, in a way, I don't struggle with it because I know that our experiences make us who we are. And those people that don't share those same experiences then have a difficulty in understanding where you, why you might do or not do something. Because over the last 10 years, I've had many friends say to me, why didn't you just leave? Because I'm still currently in a not enviable position regarding my home, my earthquake home. I feel now that because I've done the gardening and maybe the music's some of that music's come back just to listen to it and mm-hmm. other people's music. I'm on a more of a healing path. I keep meeting people in Christchurch who are absolutely broken. I have not been able to move on, and for a lot of different reasons, because life, our normal lives, our families, our health, our children, and what was happening for our children at those in that period from 2010 to say 2013, where we were just a shaken city mm-hmm. because we still had the unprecedented amount of aftershocks. Yeah. Literally, so many of us had nowhere to go. We could not lift up and move.
We were living in shock.
We were in shock, and shock stultifies you. Shock stops you. You were just living day to day in many cases, and for some people, way longer than what most of the rest of the country have any idea about. I won't get into the specifics because this is not just one program. My experiences and the people I've met, what I'm still enduring, should be a documentary series with film, with interviews of people I know and how it has altered their lives irrevocably. Maybe some of it will come out and be beneficial. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to work hard on that. But I do know I've experienced, like many people, much loss, an overload of trauma. And so this whole thing where we're sitting here discussing and talking about the legacy of making music and that thing that's a heart food that we need to have in our lives to somehow, maybe it's that little connection to joy or moments of happiness is mm-hmm. what we have when we listen to certain pieces of music. The other two things are really, I've started to work very hard on to help me. It's just simply bigness of nature. And it's a hard thing to do because you have to be really mindful and you've got to try and somehow sieve out the intense media, which is always about the negative, how much change and how much stuff's going on in the world that's destructive. And we could just all fall into that pit and just go, well, what the hell? This is so big. This is so outside of one person's ability to change it. We're ourselves, but we're each other. And each other, we make a little group, or we make a family, we make a little village, we make a little community. And it's mm-hmm. that's the grassroots thing of where we have to be to change the future. And it's about awareness, and it's about kindness. It's about being kind to ourselves, being kind to each other, being kind to the earth. Go back. It's like almost we have to go full circle and go back to where it was at the very when our ancestors came here, and looking at how our Indigenous people survived here, how little they needed. But it's that interconnection with humanity and the planet, mm-hmm. the looking after the resource that keeps us together, that feeds us and waters us. Yeah. If we don't do it individually, there's no point in just, you know, giving money. You actually have to do it from the very basis of where you live. What I'm trying to get to is that if anyone says, well, what kind of music would you have done, Dan? I don't know. I could say, well, grassroots, community, roots music, because mm-hmm. it's where it came from. We didn't have resources. We only had each other. I've got the most incredible photographic collection. Luckily, we have people who love taking photos. And when I look at it, I see these wonderfully innocent young people that we were sitting around in various gardens and in early Auckland before no one could afford to live there, when everyone found a place and a roof, making music and eating wonderfully, eating good food from their gardens. And I look back now and I think, you know, I never realised until now, recently, what a golden age that was. It was another golden age. Yeah.
Denny, so I'm just in awe of where this interview has gone, and you know, and just the stories and whatnot. And this is truly, truly, when I think of a legacy series, this is what it really is about. We have so many stories. Your stories, they're important. And thank you. It's an honor. It's a real privilege to hear your story, and I'm extremely grateful.
Thank you. I'm getting tears in my eyes now.
But, I am too.
Oral history. What you're doing, and I'm so honored and respectful and very grateful that you went to the effort to find me. I wasn't easy to find at this point in my life.
You weren't.
And because the stories, and I've always thought that oral history needs to be there. Histories need to be recorded so that people's, where we've been, the social history of our lives doesn't get lost. And so I think it's amazing. I'm sorry if I've rambled, because this has been so off the cuff, not planned and no set questions or anything. We've just had a conversation.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving. How can they know it's time for them to go? I know it will be so. Until it's time to go.
Women in Music podcast was made possible through a funding grant by the Christchurch Foundation Women's Fund, Te Ira Wahine o Otutahe. And special thanks to our community radio sponsor, Plains FM 96.9, Christchurch.